Our speaker tonight is Jason Lee from the Joys of Recovery Home Group in Chesapeake. Please put your hands together and welcome Jason, our speaker tonight.
Thank you. My name is Jason. It's actually Jason D, my last name. And I'm an alcoholic.
Sorry, Jason.
No worries. I'll be pretty casual, pretty informal. I only have this here for the clock aspect. Kind of my story of pretty much, I guess the first part's a lot around how I did not do Alcoholics Anonymous. Because I've not done Alcoholics Anonymous aggressively a lot longer than I've done Alcoholics Anonymous. I grew up, I was born up in New Hampshire, one of five boys, one girl. And I don't have a big, when I was 11, I had my first sip of whiskey. I started in high school, somebody stole a 12 pack. I got a couple of them. It was cool. When I was young, it was that, you hear it all the time, it was that tension reliever, that comfort. I became taller, I became smarter, I became more friendly and funnier and all those other things. And that was kind of my whole, my young adulthood. It was something that was very good with social aspects. One thing I will say is in regards to Virginia, I grew up most of my life actually in Texas, although I've lived overseas quite a bit as well. But a big step forward probably in my drinking was in 1990, my family moved from Texas and arbitrarily chose to move to Virginia. We were living in far west Texas, Midland, Texas. We weren't in the oil and gas business, but my stepfather, who I grew up with, his business was dependent on that oil and gas money to buy his products. And so when it fizzled out, I don't know if they took a dart and threw it at a map or what, but they chose Virginia. And I was 18. I had to finish my senior year of high school. I didn't want to come. They lured me with an old beat up car and were like, look, you'll have your own car. And I fell for it. And we moved to Great Bridge, which is, I live in Chesapeake now. But that was for 1 year. And when I got up here, I showed up, and if you're from Texas or you're familiar with Texas, I came up here in 1990 with a nice proper mullet. My mom had recently permed it. It was nice and curly in the back. I immediately did not fit in, but I made it a pretty quick decision that moving to Virginia, I wasn't going to be this kind of introverted, shy guy that sat in the back and was, waiting for others to acknowledge me. And I went to the first big party at Great Bridge High School out at Sandbridge that I could, and I drank and I introduced myself to everybody at that party. My name's Jason, I'm from Texas. And that was a big moment as far as I remember that, breaking that ice. And the next week I went into school and random people that I didn't remember were like, hey, Jason. And I was like, hey, what's up? And I was like, I was in. And it was so, again, that social aspect of it. Moving ahead, I kind of had a very odd direction in life. I went to a very conservative college back in Texas. I didn't really know what I wanted to do. I grew up in my later teens, etc., in the church. I had a lot of respect for the church, but certain people that had really had an inspiration on me. And I thought I would do something within the church, whether it was like teach, be a missionary, something like that. I just knew that at least that year after high school, with a lack of anything else to do, it seemed like an easy next step, and I could go to Dallas, and I knew some people down there. So I went and I picked that up, and that immediately shut down any drinking. You could not drink, you could not smoke. I almost got kicked out because I couldn't quit smoking at the time. So at least while I was present at the campus, there was no drinking allowed. When I'd come home to Virginia for holidays, like now, my brothers, we'd all drink. Have fun, whatever, but it was easy to shut it off when I went back to school because it wasn't allowed. So basically, in college, I had some things that happened that I now, in hindsight, look back on as far as having shaped me. And one of them was I was in a very long-term relationship for 3 years, pretty much knew that my relationship, that family life was going a certain direction, and my career was going kind of a specific direction. And through a turn of events, and with the help of alcohol, everything for me got pulled out from under my feet. The woman didn't want anything to do with me. The school said, you can no longer be a part of us because alcohol was involved. And I, oddly enough, had a ticket to take my first international trip of my life, to leave the U.S. And go to Chile for 2 months, South America. And so the school dumps me, the girl dumps me, I got a ticket, and I get on an airplane and I go to Chile. And after a couple of months there, I guess you'd say I kind of became quite lost as far as what my next step was. And I was invited by I was living with a family, a Chilean family down there. I found a way to make some money teaching English part-time. And I was like, I can just start my life right here. And alcohol was a big part of that. Again, I needed that social lubricant. I did not speak Spanish at the time. And English wasn't the big language it is now in the early 90s. So it was either learn some Spanish, and get embarrassed all the time, or be very, very lonely. And alcohol was the perfect lubricant to help you learn a foreign language. So if you didn't know that, now you know. I couldn't afford to drink probably what I would have drank, which is probably good. I drank as much, you know, I lived hand to mouth. You know, I would teach a few classes, get paid once a week, have enough for, you know, I knew where I could go in Santiago, Chile and get a hot dog with all the fixings and a beer for $1, you know, and that was like the meal, the main meal of the day. But it was a good life, it was a free life, and it was a very poor life, which for me, and even today, is a very free life. You know, I know poverty is, you know, kind of like, you know, humility is something that's almost looked down upon, but some of the happiest people I've met in my life were, you know, had the bare necessities. And at that point in Chile, Santiago, at the time I was there, was the largest economy in the Western Hemisphere. They were growing crazy, but you could get on a bus and go 30 minutes out of town, and you were dirt roads, generators, no water, but you know, you see 10 kids, you give them a soccer ball, and they're good for like 6 months. You know, that's it. That's all they need, and I really appreciated that. So basically, after a year of that, I ended up coming back to the States. I had to start paying off student loans, figure out my next phase, and from there on, you know, I was thinking about this just a couple of weeks ago, or even a few days ago, kind of that whole, you know, I'm always thinking back on how did I get where I'm at right now, which is 54 with almost three years coming up, 3 years sobriety. Sorry, I didn't say that. My sobriety day is February 8th, 2023. I have a sponsor. I meet with my sponsor now 2+ years in on a regular basis still. As long as he'll keep listening to my BS, I'll keep spouting it. He's got a sponsor. I have a home group, which is Joys of Recovery up in Chesapeake. So basically, thinking again back to my past, I realized that really in those 90s, when I went to Santiago after college, there's probably not many days that went by that I didn't consume alcohol of some sort. To some level. It might have been a couple beers for the edge down in Santiago. Then I moved back to the States and I just worked odd jobs. You know, I never drank during work most of my life. But it was always the go-to at the end. I always was close to my older brothers. They were drinkers, not like me, but they, you know, were social drinkers. And then in 1999, I got a job. And then I moved to West Africa. And I was based on land. Again, it was another excuse that I needed. I was warned when I was interviewing for the job, it was through IT stuff for oil and gas companies. And I interviewed with a gentleman who was in the country at the time, and purely over the phone. And based on his acceptance, I was gonna fly to Africa, which was, even though I'd been in South America, that was a big, big deal. But he literally offered me the job on the phone. And the one warning he gave me is when you get here, it's a bunch of rednecks running a gas plant, be thick-skinned, Because I'm the one who makes your internet come and go. I'm the one who makes your phones work. They're going to be rough on you. And I was like, okay. And sure enough, alcohol was great for that. Because, you know, they'd complain. I'd be like, well, let's go get some beers and talk about it, you know. And that kind of lifestyle, you're rotational back when I was there. So you're a month in country, a month out of country. And every day of work ends up out on the patio with all the beer you can drink. And, you know, and then hard work the next day. And that was 7 years. I did that. And then, you know, they flew us business class, so it was all you could drink. I have a lot of anxiety about flying. To date, I hate to fly, and I had to fly all the time, you know. And from here to West Africa, it's like 18 hours just in a plane. And then I had to get in helicopters, go out to oil rigs all the time. And so basically, the way I kind of summarize all that part of my life is, you know, it's kind of like, you know, alcohol became kind of my solve-all, my duct tape was this analogy I've been using kind of lately. You know, got a little leak, I throw some duct tape on it. Duct tape fixes everything. You know, I made everything better. You know, somebody didn't like me, duct tape. You know, I didn't get the raise I thought I had, duct tape. And I just kept building this wall of duct tape. And then it kept solving more and more problems. You know, at first it was a horrible breakup with a woman. And then the next thing, you know, I had to move to a new country. Wow, I'll just lubricate myself and become the most social person I possibly can be. And, you know, it just kept, over time, I kept applying it to more and more things. Like I said, I never drank during work. I never take that with a grain of salt. I did end up, you know, especially when COVID came in, I ended up working shorter hours, which was convenient. But all that went good up until, you know, I managed. If you can say that there's a functional alcoholic, then I was that guy. I do the happy hours, the customer things. I really worked a very structured, like I'm sure a lot of you, as far as how much alcohol do I have, how much do I need. Even though I was single most of my life, I'd never kept alcohol in the house. I didn't have anybody to hide alcohol from, but I refused to buy big bottles because I would drink them. So I would go to that store and I'd buy, you know, I went through phases of beer and whatever. And then I went into a full-on vodka only. And then other phases, like my last phase, was red wine. Because it's classy. And, but I would never keep it at home, you know, quantities. It was always the pints, sometimes half pints, you know, like six of them a day. But that was always going to be the last one. So things started to catch up to me. I had another relationship for many years in 2014, 15, 16. That kind of got invasive. It started interrupting my ability to drink. We started living together more and more. The idea of hiding came into my mind, of having to please somebody else kept coming in. And I took on a job, very good job as far as financially beneficial, amazing company, but it was a very, very high stress job. It wasn't my personality. It was a sales role, and I was supposed to produce $25 million of product sales a year, and I had to tell every week exactly how much I expected to close that week. And it's hard to take $25 million and divide it into 52 weeks and guess, you know, and management wanted to know. And when you were way off and you'd like, you said $1 million and we did $500, then you got a lot to explain for. And it was a very high pressure job. And so I was, my after work drinking, it was also a remote job. COVID had started hitting back at this, or no, not yet, COVID wasn't there yet, but it was still, I got to work remotely a lot. It was for an IT company, so, you know, we had video conference equipment and all that other stuff. So again, the days could start and end based on what I had to accomplish, not on a punching in or punching out. And I began to drink more and more. And then I arranged a trip with some college friends of mine. So obviously somewhat conservative people from my Bible college days. These were two young ladies who had been very close to me. They were sisters. And I decided we're going to go. They had both gotten divorced. One of them was from my best friend in college. And one was from another friend from college. And then they all got divorced. And I said, let's go to Mexico. And we're going to celebrate being single. And I had all this money, and I was living large, but my drinking was really getting to a point of being uncontrollable. You know, getting to work was tough. Holding the shaky hands over the keyboard in an open office space was very difficult. So I was looking forward to this trip, though I was anxious to see these people I hadn't seen in a long time. So I flew them into Houston, where I was living, and they spent one night, so I took them out to the best bar in town that everybody knew my name. Showed them how important I was and how much I could drink. Don't remember going home. All I know is the next day I had to pack for a week in Mexico in about 5 minutes, and I did it, and we got on a plane and went to Mexico. And to cut to that point, and where the first time that finally alcohol slapped me in the face, I was in Mexico on this trip. We were on like 3 days in. And on the first day, I realized, even though I had a bracelet that said I could stop anywhere in this resort and say I would like this drink or that drink, I knew that wasn't going to be enough because these people were going to be around me. So I went to the gift shop, and all they had was like gift bottles of tequila like you'd be taking home to someone. And I'm like, perfect, I'll keep that in my room for those morning shakes and all that. 3 days into that, I'll try to fast forward here. We had gone to eat. We did an off-site tour, got in a tour bus, went into other parts of down south of Cancun. And we ended up in this water park kind of a place. And it was like a big lake. And we went to get on, well, start off, we went to have lunch at a Mexican place, of course, in the resort. And while we're sitting there, I was trying to calm my drinking down a little bit because I could tell that they were getting a little antagonized by me. So we sat down at this restaurant, and I ordered a margarita, of course, and it came. And I remember I picked up that margarita, and these two young ladies are sitting here, and it was shaking so bad in my hand, I immediately dropped it right back down on the table. And I'm like, I can't do that. So then I did the maneuver, if you're familiar with it, where you just lean it towards you, touching the table, and I managed to get one margarita down. I'm like, that'll calm the shaking. Didn't calm the shaking. So then I ordered another margarita. And I didn't want to drink it all because then they might think I'm an alcoholic, but I couldn't get rid of the shakes. So I was in a whole cluster. And basically, they were like, we decided to go do a little, you get in inner tubes, you go down this little river into this big lake, and we start going, one of the ladies in front of me, and then one's behind me, and we're just individually floating out. And then I was feeling something going on physically. It was hard to explain. It's like I was twitchy, this weird thing, and then I had a seizure in the middle of this lake in an inner tube. Last thing I remember was I felt like electricity going up my brain. Somebody yelled my name from behind me. Thankfully, there was somebody behind me, and I went in the water, woke up in a bed in a little clinic at this resort, and I was all damp. I don't remember anything really from there really on. They put me in a wheelchair, brought me back to the bus to go back to our resort. Apparently, I had a grand mal seizure is what I was told. It was about four and a half minutes, she said. I know I almost cut my tongue in half, but I didn't, but it next day, I could barely talk because my tongue was so swollen. But that night, one of the girls was like, well, I'm not leaving you in your room because we don't know what the hell's wrong with you. And we don't want you to have a seizure and nobody around. So apparently, I didn't know it, but I had another seizure that night, smaller. And they were like, that's enough. And they took me in a taxi up to Cancun, checked me into the emergency room. So all of that for the next 3 or 4 days is kind of a blur. I was in the hospital like two nights. They took my phone, began to call all my family back here in Virginia. I had a brother, I have a brother still in Miami. And they were like, you know, our trip's over in like 3 days and we're going home, but your son's in the hospital. So good luck with that kind of a deal, you know. So they took all my clothes from the hospital. They went in, packed up my room, found an empty bottle of tequila, which I got to hear about for the next couple days. And that was it. You know, I didn't have my phone, I didn't have anything. And finally, after 2 days, even though thanks to Chile, I spoke Spanish, I didn't speak medical Spanish. So they were running all these tests, had me highly medicated, and I checked myself out. They found my pair of boxers, and I had a robe, and then I went out and found a cab and went back to the resort. Needless to say, the girls didn't really want anything to do with me anymore. We endured it, I continued to drink, I'd say probably as much as ever. I didn't do the addition in my head that I was an alcoholic or that it was the alcohol that caused this. It took a long time for that admission to come. So that trip ended. So I came back to the States, and my family's freaked out. I mean, the doctor had told them on the phone, your son's an alcoholic, he's going through withdrawal. If he told me that, I don't remember it, but they were told that, and they were very shocked by it, which kind of surprises me in hindsight, because I drank for a long time around them, and I was always just on that verge of being annoying. But they were shocked by it. To them, at least in my perspective, is I was the guy who called them from the Eiffel Tower and said, hey, what's up? I'm in Paris, or hey, I'm in Spain, or I'm in Italy. I was like running around the world, living this great life, when really I was doing that, lubricated the entire way through all those places I was going. So I came back, went to my doctor, and began a whole series of tests. They sent me to neurologists and stuff to do some brain stuff, every test you can think of. And then I ended up about 3 months later, because I took my time doing those tests, back to my doctor. And for the first time, I sat down and I came in with some new complaints. I was like, my back hurts too, by the way. And I'm still drinking. I probably tried to mellow it out, but I'm still drinking. And my back hurts and I'm having the sleep issues, man. And he's like, Jason, there's one issue that's causing all of this. And I was like, really? This is going to be good information. You're an alcoholic. I didn't like that at all. But it was literally the first time someone said it straight up to my face. I mean, I had other things I remember back in time. I think I knew I was an alcoholic for a long time. I always thought I'd get my grip on it. Usually it was tomorrow. That was the end of my whole story. Everything was going to be done tomorrow. But that was my first to my face. So he basically said, look, you need to go to an AA meeting and I'll continue on these medications so you don't have a seizure, but you need to stop drinking. So I said, I'll just finish up. So I said, yeah, okay, and I quit drinking and here I am. No, that's not how it worked. Yeah, it didn't work. I said, okay, I'll do better. And I think I told him I went to an AA meeting. I don't think I ever did. I'm proud. I'm egotistical. I lived in Africa. I lived in South America. I don't need somebody to tell me how not to drink. And that was kind of the story that went on for years. So a couple months later, I ended up finally, through family intervention in admission that I was out of control, I ended up in my first treatment center up in Maryland. My mother and sister-in-law at the time found a place. They thought, I guess some of the places like Farley and things weren't here at the time. This was in 2017, I think. And Maryland seemed close enough that they could come visit on the weekends. Very nice place. We had a pool, hot tub. We had acupuncture, massages. We played with horses sometimes. I mean, it was top notch. There were only eight or nine of us clients. I met with a counselor every day for like 2 hours. Insurance paid for everything. Kind of a repetitive story for me. In about 2 weeks, I was ready to join the staff, start becoming a counselor, telling everybody else how to get sober. I'm like, yeah, this works, man. Look at me. I haven't had a drink in 2 weeks. Yeah. I'm locked up and I can't go anywhere and I have no wallet, but I haven't had a drink. And it's funny, when you get to rehab, the whole desire to drink really kind of diminishes because you don't have anything to worry about. And I get, my arrogance, my cockiness comes back very quickly. And I had an amazing counselor. I'm still in touch with her today on occasion. But I did that. They said, you should stay another week. And I'm like, yeah, insurance, do it. And I left and they said, okay, now take what we taught you in Maryland, go back to Houston, and then go build it on your own. No, it didn't happen. I went to some meetings. I sat back there in the corner. Didn't know the people, didn't get them. It was, we did meetings when we were in treatment. They take us out to random churches, NA meetings, AA meetings, but I didn't have any experience. I didn't have a fellowship. I didn't have a single person that I could say, I'm an alcoholic, and have anything. And I probably made it 3-4 months. Went to meetings, different meetings, became restless. And then at some point, decided, you know, I'll just think I'll have one drink and then tomorrow I'll get back out of that sober thing. And for me, I'd never slipped and went and got a white chip. I was talking to my sponsor the other day, I don't think I've ever picked up a white chip. I wasn't going back to this meeting tomorrow and admitting failure. Who wants to complete it, you know, admit complete failure? And, you know, that was not me. I'd go to Williamsburg, D.C., you know, whatever, but I just, you know, I was very proud and egotistical, and I wasn't going to do that. So took that one drink, and then for me, that's the, we call it breaking the seal. And once I had that one, I could not stop. And I didn't go back in a week. I didn't go back in a month. I went back a year later when the bottom dropped back again. And so to fast forward through that, from 2017 till 2023, which is my sobriety date, February 2023, I went through four inpatient treatment facilities, two in Florida, one in Miami, one in Tampa, one in Houston, and one in Maryland. Probably 10 or 12 detoxes, because like everybody, you just need 4 days of sobriety, and I got it. You know, I'll be in control then. My willpower will take over. Tried an IOP, made it through about 3 weeks of that. Got one positive test, just barely, they said, just barely positive. And they said, but if you come back and you test positive again, you're out. And so I like to say I showed them and I never went back. They weren't going to get my positive because it was going to be positive. I manipulated it forever. I was hard-headed, egotistical. I did get a couple sponsors over the years, men that I have great respect for, did what they could do at the time, but I wasn't to that point of desperation. I don't think anybody has to get to my point of desperation. But I'm like the cliche of all the sayings.
Right here.
One day at a time? No. How am I gonna get sober in a year? How am I gonna be sober in a year? You know, I wanted to plan out everything. I even wonder, and I've talked about it with some of my friends recently about, you know, when I went to that first rehab, I don't even know what my expectation was. I don't think it was gonna be like, you're never gonna drink again. It was like, you're gonna quit embarrassing yourself and wasting time and pissing people off, and you're gonna drink like a normal human being. That's what I think I probably thought. The idea of never drinking again, I don't know when that occurred, but that might be a requirement for me. So basically, I never lost a job. Like I said, I didn't drink during work. It became, you know, probably 15, 20 years ago, it probably became the stop at the store, grab some chicken, grab a bottle of wine, go home, cook, drink the bottle of wine, to go to the store, get two bottles of wine and some chicken. And then, you know, at points it became, bring a wine opener with you in the car, and then you can just go ahead and open it in the parking lot, or pop that vodka. And, you know, it went from, oh, I need a nice chaser with some ice cubes, and then it became just take the vodka. Oh, I don't have a chaser. That's okay. I don't need it. My throat's built for that, you know. It got ugly. It got very ugly. And in 2000, I can't even tell you the dates. In 2020, I believe, is where the first time, or 21, I just gotten hired by a new company. This was when COVID started to kind of, it was in, but it didn't diminish my work. And I left to a job by choice, and then I was immediately hired by another company by my reputation. I had a good reputation in my industry of satellite communications. It was a friend who worked at another company. How much do you need to make? And I said, this much. And he said, can you start tomorrow? And I said, sure. And at this point, I think I'd had a nice little month or two delay between my prior job that I left intentionally. And I just stayed home and drank, so I had to get in work condition, and it didn't work out very well. I ended up going to that company, had a great job. It was a little strange. It was kind of a startup, but after about 8 months of not producing anything, really tangible. And I'm going to take the blame out. You know, there are some things with them, but they brought me into the conference room. I had a 17th floor office right in the Galleria area of Houston. And they brought me into the conference room and they're like, you know, you're not who we thought we were hiring. Because they knew my reputation from knowing me 5 years ago, 6 years ago, when I was still producing things. And I didn't, had no argument, nothing. You know, to be honest, there's a few times in my life when I've really had a sense of relief. It was the first time I ever, my sister-in-law called me in 2016 and said, or 17, 16, and said, hey, she had just visited me. She said, I think you're an alcoholic, or I think you have a problem. And I was immediately started crying. And I was like, you are right. I'm a mess. And I felt such a relief that it was out. I had said it out loud. And then, you know, once you admit it, then you go drink a lot. Because you're like, now they expect it of me, so I got to produce. But that, going to a treatment center, and when they fired me, I remember, you know, they were like, sorry, but, you know, go ahead and pack your stuff. And I was like, damn, back to all day again. Like, just drink all day. And that's what I did. For the last year and a half, 2 years out, and I don't know the time frame. It's a big blur to me. But I went from, you know, I had guys I golfed with twice a week, a group of, we'd be 6 or 12 of us out there, great time, lots of drinking. But I was always that guy that came in and had a couple pre-golf drinks and then drank like them during it and then whisked off home to finish off by myself. And that began to be like, you know, I don't need the golf, I'll just drink at home. And, you know, I was a guy that would go to happy hours and then I'd be like, I gotta go home and get a drink and then go to the happy hour and then leave early before I get, you know, and that's, like I said, the math equations that I was always playing in my head. You know, when am I gonna have too much? Fortunately, my friends drank pretty heavily, but not in the fashion that I did, you know. It was an exception for them to have a little too much. You know, for me, it was a daily, you know, I hated blackouts. I wasn't a blackout drinker intentionally. I had plenty of them, but I hated that feeling of not knowing what I did. I hated that feeling. So I tried to avoid that, but I used to always think if I could just learn to sleep, I would get over alcohol. But I, you know, it was my solution for sleep, which has been a lifelong problem. So basically, in 2021, I had no job now. I was financially okay, so I didn't hit that bottom. I was in no rush to get back to work. COVID was still a big deal. It was perfect time to take some time off and be home and not worry about anything. And I began to withdraw from all these social activities, no more golf. My friends would just kind of give up on calling me. Oh, you know, it was going to come, it's something, you know, whatever excuse for the day. And then I began getting sick. Basically, I really didn't know what was going on. I mean, I became very isolated for a long time, probably a year for the most part. I hated going out. You know, that duct tape, I mean, I could not have enough duct tape. If I wanted a haircut and I had to talk to somebody, I needed to be buzzing. If I had to go get groceries, which I didn't like to, I just wanted to get what I needed for the day and be out. I had to enter, you know, I found some home delivery liquor, which was convenient, but it was very expensive. And one time they got to run your license when they get to your house, and it didn't go through, and we almost got into a fight because they wanted to take the liquor back to the liquor store. But, so I became very isolated, and I began to get very sick. My abdomen began to grow a lot. I began to have issues walking. At some point, those last 3 or 4 months, the police came to my house, I think twice, because I wouldn't answer my phone anymore to my own family up here in Virginia. And they'd come do a welfare check, and I'd just say, I'm good, go away. And they don't, I mean, my apartment was a disaster. I gave up throwing the wine bottles away. I just piled them around. I fell down a couple times in public, and I was unable. The last time, the fire, ambulance, police all showed up to pick me up off of a sidewalk in the front of a Chinese restaurant. Began to lose a lot of control of my everything, and my brain became kind of fuzzy all the time. And finally, thank God, I began to open up to my family a little bit about, I'm having some health issues. I don't know if I'm going to have twins or triplets, but there's something going on in this belly of mine that ain't right. And I don't go to a doctor unless, you know, there's desperation involved. And my sister, fortunately, is a nurse up here, and a hospice nurse, and has a great lot of knowledge on cirrhosis and ascites and all those liver problems. And she's like, you need to go to the ER tomorrow, or no, sorry, right now, immediately. And I'm like, let me do one thing, and I'm going to go tomorrow. And my family would, my parents would call me, and they're like, okay, you're in the hospital. And I'm like, no, there's this one other thing that I need to get done, which I had nothing to do. there's a great story that my sponsor loves. Those last few days, weeks, months, don't know. You know, I was like, somehow, before I leave this apartment, because I don't know when I'm going to come back if I go to the hospital. And if maintenance can't come in here, they're going to condemn this place. If anybody walks in here, it's an embarrassment. And but I could no longer like bend over. It hurt everything. I was exhausted. I had no muscles. I had atrophied sitting on the couch all day, drinking all day. And I went, I was at CVS, I'm sure getting my daily supply of wine, and they had one of those picker-upper things, like if the remote's too far away, you can scoop it and grab it. And I'm like, that's the solution to all my problems. And I got that in a box of trash bags, and I went and sat on my couch. And this is the truth, is I sat there and thought, I'm gonna pick up these 150 wine bottles individually and put them in this bag and set them out front or get them down the stairs. I mean, I could not even walk up my, I was on the second floor. I had to take a break to walk up to the, you know, I had to stop halfway, catch my breath and get, and then pause, get up to my apartment door, go in and fall onto the couch and then just be panting. Because once your abdomen and all this, all your organs are just jammed up in here, and I could not talk. I couldn't, I just became very short of breath. So basically my parents called, and I'll fast forward here as much as I can, but they finally called after about 4 days of tomorrow, and they said, look, if you're not in the hospital tomorrow, we're driving down there, and we're gonna get your ass to the hospital. And I was like, oh man, they can't see this, where I lived and how I smelled. And I had a beard of like 7 months and hadn't had a haircut in a year. And I'm like, I'm gonna have to go to the hospital. And so the next day I got up and I went to the hospital to avoid them coming, driving 24 hours. And I went, got to the hospital. And after having those falls, I sat out front, right, looking right at the emergency room sliding doors. And I sat there for like 20 minutes. And I'm like, I was scared to walk to the doors, and I would fall in the middle of the parking lot of the hospital, which is probably a good place to fall. But so I called them and I said, I can't. And they came in and they brought me a wheelchair, brought me in the hospital, got me through everything real quick, checked in, medicated real quick. And then they brought me into some ER room and they began a process which is called paracentesis, which is where they take a big needle and they jam it into your stomach. And then they take another needle that goes inside of that, and by nothing but pressure alone, it begins to drain that fluid, because the liver has shut down, so it's just passing fluid. And that dirty blood that it's supposed to clean out before it goes to your brain, it's just going to your brain, and all that bodily fluid that you should be getting rid of is just accumulating. And they poked me, and there's a long skinny tube, and it went to a bottle, a 1 liter bottle, glass, everything's clear, conveniently, so I could just see it all. And they filled up a bottle, and then they went, fill up a second bottle, fill up a third, fill up a fourth. 11 liters of fluid they pulled out of me in about an hour, hour and a half. All of the, again, just pressure. There's no sucking. It's just my body saying, go. And I felt a lot better. I lost the ability to walk pretty immediately. The next day, well, I will say that night, to my own surprise, my parents had called me a few times, and I was so happy to say, I'm in the hospital. And then that night, they showed up and knocked on my door in the hospital. And I'm like, damn it, they came down anyway. So I didn't get away with it, and they were shocked to see me. They tried it. You know, that was kind of the first point in my life that all the hiding of my alcoholism came to kind of an end. It was, you know, there was no, this happened yesterday. No, I didn't. This filth didn't happen. This was an accumulation of months and months and months. And then they asked to go to my apartment, and I said, no, you can't go to my apartment. And I can't go into the details because it was so horrid, the condition it was in. Think of your worst episode of Hoarders or whatever, and it was on that level. And I refused to give them the key the first day, and they were like, okay. And then the second day they came in and they said, look, let us go to the apartment. We're going to get some clothes for you. You're wearing the same clothes for like 4 days. And I'm like, no, you can't go. You can't go. You cannot see how I've been living for the last year or however. And they said, don't worry. Your uncle was an alcoholic. We helped him. And I'm like, no. And I surrendered and I gave them the key. And they left and they came back about 3 hours later. You know, it's a mile down the road. And they said, we cannot touch that. We got to call some special company that does that kind of stuff. And it cost me $6,000 to clean that apartment up. So basically, so the first day, 11 liters. Second day, they did 7.6 liters more. So that's, I don't know, it's like 35, 40 pounds of fluid they pulled out of. I'm 150 pounds. And medicated, you know. Again, cirrhosis of the liver with ascites, which is that constant accumulation of abdominal fluid. From then on, over that first year to year and a half, I probably was poked in the gut a dozen more times. Every month or two, I had to weigh myself every day, keep my blood pressure every day, take a lot of medication to keep things flowing. And if I saw a quick spike, or I would feel like my belly like getting distended, I'd go in and they'd be like, "Oh, yep, you're we need to drain it." And at points, I thought I was gonna do the rest of my life. So after that, get out. My parents had to come back to Virginia and, you know, continue with life. So they took me to a treatment facility. And to be honest, it was the worst treatment facility I've been to. And I hated every minute. And I complained about the food and the people and the recovery. And they didn't know what they were doing because I was an expert. And, you know. But it was exactly what I needed, which was a place to sleep, 3 meals a day, and take medication. And we had decided when they were there, because I had nothing left in Texas, that I would come up here. Again, I've been in and out of AA. I'd been in and out over the years, you know, mostly in a treatment center. I didn't get the desperation to do the work on my own or take suggestions, take help. But this time, yeah, I knew I was done. You know, the alcohol wasn't there anymore. And all that horrid mess that I lived in, you know, I hear people all the time share, and they're like, oh, I was had a gun to my head or in my mouth. And I had guns. I never wanted to. There was some little spark of hope that was like, somehow I'm going to fix this tomorrow. Of course, tomorrow. But then I got sober, and I thought, at least I'll come to Virginia and have family. They're going to put up with my shit to the very, very end, where AA may, you know, just not care. So I'll come up here, and I got brothers and sisters and nephews and nieces all over Hampton Roads. And that's what I did. So I got out, had to pack up that apartment, threw away 2/3 of my belongings, and came to Virginia. I went to a couple of meetings while I was down there. I had about 2 or 3 months. I had to use a walker the first 2 weeks I was in my treatment center down there, because that's a lot of weight to take off of you, and the body had to acclimate. So I spent a lot of time walking a block at a time, trying to get some health back. Went to a few meetings, but I think because I knew I was leaving, I didn't want to really invest. I don't think I knew what I wanted. I was very, you know, I compared that period of my life for like 3 months there, this phase, and I consider it like the worst breakup I've ever been through in my life. Like somebody took the the thing that made me feel the most comfortable and said, you can't have it anymore. And I relate it to relationships I've had where that's, she's the one, that's the one. And then you come to the realization through whatever reason, nope, it's done. And so for 3 months, I packed up, went to call meetings, came up here. And then after about 2 months here, then suicide became a thought in my head. If I don't have that, you know, and then I needed a solution. And then I got into AA. And then I found a home group and I started to make friends. And I finally sat down with somebody. I mean, I had a home group first. And about 3 months of building community here, I began to, I got a sponsor and I began to work these steps. And I got, for the first time in my life, from 4 to 5 to 6 to 7 to 8 to 12. And for me, that's kind of where I'm at now. I love the program. I do what I can in the program. I'm still a meeting a day kind of guy for the most part. I go to treatment centers when I can. My friends are in AA. I'm happy to be friends with anybody in or out of AA. I'm not ashamed that I'm an alcoholic. If I see alcohol, my family still drinks around me all the time. Go for it. It's not for me. I cannot touch it. I never plan to touch it again. So that's where I'm at. I'm glad you all got to listen. Hopefully somebody could relate to some part of that. Hopefully you don't. Hopefully you never have to. But I believe in the program. I believe in asking for help. You know, like I said, I had that sponsor. And then slowly, it's been a long process for me to start to trust the rest of y'all. You know, I was in there. I was the one sitting in the back of the room going, yeah, your shit don't make sense to me. You know what I mean? And I had it all figured out those first 2 weeks. But now I know every meeting's not for me, much as I want, and I'm about me, so I want the meetings to be for me. I do believe it is a progressive program, and as long as I'm moving in a direction, I'm where I'm supposed to be. So thanks for letting me share.
Thank you, Jason, and I apologize for Jason Lee. It was Jason D. from Joys of Recovery. Jason, thank you for sharing your story tonight. I heard something the other night, and I always try to pick out something that I'm listening to with the speakers that